Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau. Halloween has long been one of the most popular holidays of the year. It's also become the largest seasonal marketing campaign outside of Christmas. So as we celebrate yet another Halloween this week, we thought we would take a look at its history, its cultural history, with the author of a new book on the subject, David Scull. Later in the show, Andrew Basevich will be here to offer some historical comparisons between the war in Iraq and World War II, focusing on what Presidents Bush and Roosevelt asked of the American people during each of those conflicts. And Alex Berza will treat us to another of his historical hoaxes. This week, the traveling stones of Paranagut Valley. But first, our history in the news. For centuries, Robin Hood, the dashing chivalrous hero to the oppressed, has been the property of Nottinghamshire in the British Midlands, the land of Sherwood Forest, Nottingham Castle, and one nefarious sheriff. But now Yorkshire and a budding county is laying claim to the 800-year-old legend and demanding that Nottinghamshire take down signs along the motorway proclaiming the county Robin Hood country. As you would imagine, the leaders of Nottingham are fighting back. After all, one quipped, who's ever heard of the Sheriff of Sheffield? I don't know why Yorkshire is being so sensitive, said John Hartshorne, Deputy Mayor of Nottingham. They have their icons, Yorkshire pudding, for example. Yorkshire's a very beautiful place, and they could do a lot with that without poaching on our icons. According to most historians, the Master Archer, the man committed to spreading the wealth was probably an amalgam of several men who lived in different time periods in various places. But the folks of Nottingham and Yorkshire don't seem particularly interested in that historical tidbit. And another historical tidbit is making the news, namely Davy Crockett's coonskin cap, or at least the cap Fess Parker wore in the 1950s portrayal of Davy Crockett on television. Parker has donated the cap to the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of American History. You had to have one, Parker, now 79, said upon presenting the cap to museum officials. And there are many men and women who told me they became very interested in history through the shows. Smithsonian historian Dwight Blocker Bowers agrees. Generations have learned about a mythic version of American history by watching these shows. If ever there was a figure who is immediately conjured by seeing an artifact, it's Fess Parker. You can just hear the song in your head. And finally, perhaps America's most famous magician who died on Halloween 1926 is back in the news. Harry Houdini, who gained fame by seemingly cheating death through daring escapes, now has a museum in his honor in his hometown of Milwaukee. The problem is that the museum plans to reveal the secrets of his great escapes. Magicians are outraged. It's tantamount to someone coming on Saturday morning kids' TV and saying, "Guess what? There's no Santa Claus," said illusionist David Sebeck. "But we're putting people in his shoes," responded a spokesman for the museum. "Part of the story of Houdini is telling the story of being a magician. By telling people how his tricks work, we're giving people a deeper meaning of the man and his art." Next up, a cultural history of Halloween. And later in the show, our weekly commentary and another of Alex Berza's historical hoaxes. This is Talking History.
Born on a mountaintop in Tennessee, greenest state in the land of the free, raised in the woods so's he knew every tree, kilted him a bar when he was only three. Davy, Davy Crockett, king of the wild frontier.
Halloween is one of the most popular holidays of the year, drawing millions of children and more than a few adults into the streets, going door to door, trick-or-treating, or attending costume parties. In economic terms, it's also a major holiday, second only to Christmas, with estimates on economic impact ranging from $4 to $6 billion. Well, with us this week to explain how this came to be, the origins and evolution of Halloween, is David Scull, the author of Death Makes a Holiday, A Cultural History of Halloween. Scull's also the author of Hollywood Gothic, The Tangled Web of Dracula, From Novel to Stage to Screen, and The Monster Show, A Cultural History of Horror. Welcome, David.
Thank you for having me, Brian.
Glad to have you. Now, you open the first chapter of your book with, "Halloween has its essential roots in the terrors of the primitive mind, which made no distinction between the waning of the sun and the potential extinction of the self." What do you mean by this?
Well, you know, all throughout human history, holiday celebrations have been closely related to the cycles of the sun, the birth and death of the seasons, and, metaphorically, the waxing and waning and rebirth of human life. To pre-industrial people, the harvest was literally a time when life and death were hanging in the balance. So it's no wonder that the ancient Celts believed that the end of October, beginning of November, was a very special and dangerous time when the veil between the world of the living and the world of the dead was especially transparent. And that was the very beginnings of the holiday we now call Halloween.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense, but clearly what we have today is very different, and I think one of the most interesting parts of your book is how you trace this history, and if I'm quoting from you again, you describe the holiday as it currently stands as a patchwork holiday, a kind of cultural Frankenstein, stitched together quite recently from a number of traditions, all fused beneath the cauldron light of the American melting pot. Wonderful wording, but let's talk about some of those traditions. You identify the Romans, for example, and their influence. How did they influence the holiday?
Halloween, like all other holidays, draws on many, many influences. Holidays are always in a state of construction, and it's important to realize the way we celebrate Halloween today has very little to do with the way it was celebrated even 100 years ago, much less back in antiquity. But when the Romans invaded the British Isles, they brought their own pagan customs, especially the Feast of Saturnalia, which involved costumes and all kinds of orgiastic excesses. And then the Christians came in.
And what about St. Patrick? What influence did he have on the holiday?
Well, St. Patrick, of course, his fame comes from his supposedly driving the snakes from Ireland. But we shouldn't take this literally because, you know, snakes never were indigenous to that island. This is really a kind of folkloric metaphor for Christianity driving out paganism.
Okay, now we move up a bit to Pope Gregory IV, and you indicate that he's important here.
Extremely, because in his attempt to convert pagan peoples to Christianity, not just in the British Isles, but all over the world, in the 9th century, Pope Gregory rearranged the church calendars so that the church holidays, or holy days, corresponded with the old pagan festivals. So now Christmas was synchronized with the old Saturnalia, the Roman holiday that occurred at the end of December, the beginning of January, and the Feast of All Saints and the Feast of All Souls were now moved to the beginning of November and created a kind of a religious mini-season known in the Middle Ages as Hallowmass or Hallowtide. And the night before these holidays, October 31st, became known as Halloween or All Hallows Evening.
Which takes us to the Renaissance, and you point out here, sort of a segue from your earlier comment, that by that time, the ritual of begging and charity had been joined with offerings for the dead. Could you explain that a bit?
Yeah, of course, the Feast of All Saints and All Souls are, in their own ways, remembrances of the dead.
Right.
And it's important to remember that most holidays revolve around rituals of sharing or distributing food, but we do have evidence in Shakespeare, in Two Gentlemen of Verona, that there was an established tradition of beggars at Hallowmass, obviously an early precursor of what we now call trick-or-treating.
Okay, by the 18th century, then, we go even beyond this ritual to, you're suggesting, elaborate masquerades that really became a cultural preoccupation among the English. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, the history of masquerade also goes back to classical antiquity, but the British really developed a taste for it in the 1700s, and it was all a matter of dressing up and acting out. The implications on the celebration of Halloween are fairly obvious. We seem to lose our inhibitions once we become anonymous behind a costume or a mask.
Well, that's true enough, or behind a radio microphone, I don't know. But you.
Oh, you should see what I'm wearing.
Maybe I don't want to. you moved to the 18th and 19th centuries, in a sense, by perhaps picking up on this masquerade aspect, by talking about how the supernatural element involving spirits of the dead or the underworld really began to wane at that point, or at least for the moment waned. Why did that come about?
Well, there was a supernatural element, but it didn't have so much to do with death or the dead. This was the era in which Halloween was imported to North America with the great immigration that came about at the time of the Irish potato famine. And the Irish and Scottish settlers in Canada and America brought many of the old traditions, but they became adapted, they became urbanized. And in the late 1800s, we really saw Halloween having more to do. It was really an adult holiday for young adults, and with emphasis on romantic fortune telling, getting a peek at your future spouse. And there were a lot of ways to do this. A lot of the rituals involved apples and looking into mirrors, you know, at midnight. And it was really fascinating, but it took on a romantic Victorian aspect without the rowdiness and social disruptions that, you know, later became associated with the holiday.
Okay, let's pick up on some of those symbols. We'll pass on the apples. You've already explained in brief where the name Halloween came from, but what about the jack-o'-lantern?
Well, jack-o'-lantern was a folklore figure in Ireland. He was a trickster figure, and he had offended God so many times, the legend went, that when he died, he was denied entrance both into heaven and into hell. The devil didn't want anything to do with him, but the devil showed him a little mercy and tossed him a burning coal from the pit of Hades, which he apparently caught in a hollowed-out turnip. And this was his lantern that was to guide him through his restless wanderings through eternity.
Well, we don't picture him very often today with a turnip. We more often see him as holding a pumpkin, I suppose. So maybe you could say, how do we make that transition, and where did the pumpkin idea come from? Does it go back to the harvest that you mentioned earlier?
Well, yes, absolutely. The pumpkin is not indigenous to Ireland and Scotland. The immigrants discovered it over here, and it's a lot easier. I tried actually carving out a turnip to see what it would be like. It makes something that looks really spooky, like a little shrunken head or something, very pale and ghastly. But pumpkins are infinitely more adaptable to this kind of craft.
Right.
And so that was a North American invention. And it was equally associated with Thanksgiving as well as Halloween. In fact, the earliest iconography I could find linked it specifically to Thanksgiving as a harvest effigy.
Interesting. So one of our earliest contributions to the ritual, I guess, is the pumpkin.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, tell us a little about, I mean, I think you've hinted at it, but maybe you ought to direct your comments to witches and the image of witches in all of this.
America, of course, or pre-America, had an obsession with witches and witchcraft. And we don't see this in the older Celtic folklore, but it gradually crept into the American celebration. And we start seeing witches, actually rather glamorous witches, not with the traditional pointed noses and hats and all dressed in black, but rather fetching Victorian Gibson girl kind of beauties. They're all over Halloween postcards from the turn of the 20th century. And it's funny today, you know, because there's often so much criticism of Halloween as having something to do with Satanism or witchcraft. And this is really an element of confusion because traditional Wiccan practice is pre-Christian and has nothing to do with the Christian God or the Christian devil. So people who practice modern witchcraft are often very annoyed at what they have to deal with around Halloween.
I may want to come back on that in a moment, but let me ask you one transition question here to kind of finish off the history. How has Halloween changed, let's say, in the past couple decades or half century in the United States?
Well, trick-or-treating especially really only came into its own in the 1950s. It was a regional, sporadic kind of thing. I was very surprised to find that in New York City, the holiday associated with kids putting on costumes and begging for treats in the streets was, until the very early 1930s, completely associated with Thanksgiving. It was something kids looked forward to. And it was really, I think, the advent of television and the decision by the major candy makers to start marketing the possibilities of Halloween in the 1950s, that kind of brought it together as a celebration that was fairly homogenous all across the United States.
Interesting. Did that, and at the same time, make it more of a children's event? I sensed all along that you're suggesting adults were fairly heavily involved, but did this transit it more directly in the way of children?
Yeah, there was a steady progression from adults to children in the first part of the 20th century, and then I think as baby boomers started to age and we all wanted to start recapturing our childhoods, the opposite occurred. And now it is really as much an adult celebration as it is for kids.
Yeah, I think that's right. Number of special events being held on Halloween for adults, especially those who perhaps aren't responsible for taking their children around the neighborhood. So
exactly.
Good point. Now, you mentioned earlier the darker side, which was this association of Halloween with witches, and I think you've addressed that pretty well. But sort of an extension of that argument is certain segments of the religious community coming out against Halloween. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, as I said, it doesn't make a lot of sense. People do get a lot of media time on both sides of the argument in October, but it also ties into this idea that Halloween is a particularly dangerous time for children. It is only in one regard, and that has to do with traffic accidents. Of course, it's a nighttime celebration. Kids are out wearing masks and costumes that can impair vision. But the idea that there is deliberate violence directed at children is kind of an urban myth that has been reinforced by Hollywood, of course, and all the Halloween and slasher movies, and things like the Tylenol poisoning scare and the anthrax scare. And somehow I think this is just kind of a scary story we want to believe, because Halloween is supposed to be about scary stories. But when you examine the statistics, there's really nothing much behind this.
You didn't find anything in your research that would suggest a connection here between the celebration of Halloween and worshiping the devil?
No. There are grotesque things that happen 365 days of the year,
right,
involving violence against children and strange cults and things like that, but it does not spike. Some ASPCAs do report an increased incidence of violence against especially black cats. There are some agencies that just will not put black cats up for adoption during the month of October. But that's also kind of anecdotal. But many, many researchers have gone into this thing about the dangers of Halloween, and it tends to be kind of vaporous. The very few cases of Halloween candy tampering that have surfaced have had to do with things like a father in Houston, Texas, who literally poisoned his own son for insurance money and tried to blame it on, you know, a Halloween serial killer.
So bad people who do bad things at any time, they don't need Halloween to cause them to do it.
Yeah, and I think parents should just take the ordinary precautions they would take at any other time of the year. But it's a wonderful holiday. It's a hands-on holiday. It's a very American holiday in the sense that we're people who are supposed to have as our birthright the ability to recreate our lives, to become anything and anyone we want, and Halloween lets us play that out. And I think it's a great time to explore creativity and theatricality, and it's not surprising. A very large percentage of Americans say Halloween is their favorite holiday, period.
Okay, great. Well, that's a great point on which to end this, so thank you, David. Happy Halloween.
Well, thank you, and look for you next year.
Okay, that'd be great. I've been speaking with David Scull, the author of Death Makes a Holiday, A Cultural History of Halloween. And when we return, Andrew Basevich draws some historical parallels between our current engagement in Iraq and World War II. This is Talking History. Many historians, including several on this show, have offered some historical perspective on the current U.S. involvement in Iraq by pointing to parallels between the current conflict and past wars. Andrew Basevich offers us still another, in this case involving presidential rhetoric on the Iraq conflict and World War II. Basevich is a professor of international relations at Boston University, where he also serves as director of the university's Center for International Relations. And he's the author of The Imperial Tense, Problems and Prospects of American Empire, published in 2003.
According to George W. Bush, the global war on terror is the central event of our time, comparable to what he calls the great struggles of the last century between those who put their trust in tyrants and those who put their trust in liberty. Yet to peel back the rhetoric is to reveal a different story. By historical standards, the enterprise that Bush's most ardent supporters have described as World War IV has turned out to be a niggling affair. The president has asked nothing and required nothing of the American people, and nothing pretty much describes what we've anteed up to support the cause. For most Americans, the global war on terror has become a little like global warming. We sense dimly that it's something we ought to take seriously, but in practice, we go about our daily routine as if it didn't exist. Which suits President Bush just fine. Real wars energize politics and subvert the established order. Change is the last thing that this administration wants. For despite all of the high-sounding talk, the overriding aim of this war is not to march toward freedom, but to dissuade Americans from peering too deeply at the events of 9/11. Were they to do so, they just might pose discomforting questions about the organization and purposes of government, the rationale of U.S. foreign policy, and above all, about who wins and who loses in American society. The contrast with World War II is instructive. To fight that war, Franklin D. Roosevelt mobilized the nation. The result was decisive victory. But with victory came other, largely unanticipated consequences. Roosevelt's crusade to liberate enslaved nations raised large questions about the meaning of freedom at home. As such, it gave impetus to the embryonic civil rights movement. It undermined old notions of a woman's place. It affirmed the rights of workers to organize and bargain collectively. It extinguished old forms of religious bigotry targeting Jews and Catholics. It created a new class of entitled, politically aware, and upwardly mobile citizens, 16 million returning veterans. Not all of the war's effects were benign, but overall, World War II reinvigorated American democracy. Small wonder that for those who fought it, the war remained the central event of their lives. Dedicating the National World War II Memorial recently, President Bush quoted Colonel Ovetta Culp Hobby, a veteran of that conflict. "This was a people's war, and everyone was in it. It was, and they were. But Bush's war isn't, and we aren't. And the difference speaks volumes about the prospects for victory and about the content of our democracy."
You've been listening to Andrew Bacevich, director of Boston University's Center for International Relations. Bacevich's commentary comes to us courtesy of the History News Service. When we return, the Traveling Stones of Paranagat Valley. Talking History regular Alex Berza, the author of The Museum of Hoaxes, is back, this time to tell us about yet another hoax in history, this one from the Nevada Territory in the second half of the 19th century.
On October 26, 1867, a story appeared in Nevada's Territorial Enterprise paper, describing some unusual stones that could be found in the Paranagat Valley of southern Nevada. According to the article, these stones, when placed nearby each other, moved of their own volition to come together. As the article put it, quote, "These curious pebbles appear to be formed of lodestone or magnetic iron ore. A single stone removed to a distance of a yard, upon being released, at once starts off with wonderful and somewhat comical celerity to rejoin its fellows." The article didn't cause that much of a reaction at first, which may have been a bit of a disappointment to its author, Dan DeQuille. DeQuille was an up-and-coming humorist who's best known today as a friend and one-time roommate of Mark Twain. DeQuille was surely hoping that someone would fall for his tall tale, but he needn't have been disappointed because the story was actually succeeding beyond his wildest dreams. Unbeknownst to him, word of the rambling rocks was spreading around the world. Soon letters about the footloose geological wonder began arriving in DeQuille's mailbox. There were just a few letters at first, curiosity seekers requesting more information. But over time, the volume of stone mail grew greater and greater. DeQuille sent polite responses, letting the correspondents know they were the victim of a tall tale, but still the letters kept coming. A German scientist wrote to him requesting delivery of a sample of the traveling stones. When DeQuille informed him that the stones weren't real, the scientist refused to believe him and accused him instead of trying to conceal the secret of the stones. Then a showman offered DeQuille $10,000 if he would go on tour with the rocks. DeQuille declined the offer, and still the letters kept coming. At this point, years had gone by, and DeQuille decided a new tactic was in order. So he began referring all inquiries to Mark Twain, assuring correspondents that Twain, quote, still had on hand 15 or 20 bushels of the stones of various sizes. This strategy didn't work either. Finally, after 12 years, DeQuille felt it was high time to publish a formal public retraction of the story, so he wrote in the November 11, 1879 edition of the Enterprise that, quote, "We solemnly affirm that we never saw or heard of any such diabolical cobbles as the traveling stones of Paranagat." But it was no use. He had created a monster that was far beyond his control. To the end of his life, letters beseeching him for more information about the miraculous mobile rocks of Paranagat Valley kept pouring in, and he was powerless to stop them.
And that's it for another week of Talking History. For more information on Alex Burza's Museum of Hoaxes, visit Burza's website, www.museumofhoaxes.com. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, Fiona Beatty, producer, Alex Smith, our studio engineer. But the opinions offered by our guests on Talking History do not necessarily reflect those of the program staff or of the Organization of American Historians. To learn more about Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. And finally, as always, we invite you to send us your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just email them to talkinghistory@umkc.edu or send them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.